Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's always a treat when you drop in and spend some time with us. Don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing going. You know how that is. We love the download, so make sure you do that. Hopefully, you guys are being safe out there. You got to be safe. Don't be stupid. Come on. You know, listen to the smart people, not the crazy ones. But lots been happening. We're in the middle of the Democratic National Convention happening this week. And then, of course, next week we'll be kicking off the Republican Convention and what all that's going to be. It's really been an interesting dynamic watching the Democrats unfold this convention day to day in a virtual space the way they have with a great deal of success, I would think. But we'll get into that. I have a great guest I've been excited to speak to, and I'm glad that she was able to join us. She is Susan Eisenhower, well-known in Washington as a policy strategist, CEO and chairman of the Eisenhower Group. And for a significant part of her career, she has provided strategic counsel on business development, public affairs, and communication projects. Also has had the distinguished career as a policy analyst. She's a chairman emeritus at the Eisenhower Institute of Gettysburg College, where she served as president not once but twice. I guess you really liked that gig, right, Susan? That's not what it was. You really enjoyed being president. It kind of runs in the family, maybe, right? You know, two terms. What can you say? She has also been a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics and a distinguished fellow at the Nixon Center, now called the Center for National Interest. One of the exciting reasons I wanted to get her on the podcast was she has a great new book out, and it's called How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. And why is it even more significant? Because she is the granddaughter of our former president, Dwight Eisenhower. And so it gives me a real special treat to welcome Susan Eisenhower to the podcast. Welcome.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. This is a real treat.
Well, we've got a lot to get into. Before we get into the crazy and you know, all of that in politics right now, I really want to start and sort of break down the book. I was reading a number of reviews on it, and it's really interesting. I was taken by this one particular point. It said, Miss Eisenhower, a Washington strategy consultant and chairman of the Eisenhower Institute, makes no pretense. How Ike Led is not a biography, history, or memoir. Instead, a unique story based upon personal experience, family letters, and interviews with Dwight Eisenhower's close friends and advisors. You personalize the president in a way that we've not seen in a long while. Talking about his time as leader during World War II and his two terms as president, what is the takeaway you want folks to have about our former president, your grandfather, and his leadership style?
Well, first of all, Michael, thank you for asking that question and also for mentioning leadership style, because I would actually say it's a leadership book, which is why it's called How Ike Led. But I've approached it from a different angle, which is that most leadership books are very formulaic, you know, the 10-point plan for becoming a leader type thing.
Right.
But I wanted to humanize this man because this was a big part of his leadership. I think he's almost unique in making some of the most consequential decisions of the 20th century, both military and political, but especially when you think about World War II and mm-hmm. the enormous situation that was unfolding and what was at stake. His decision-making capacities were, urgent and crucial. The presidency, few people look back on the 50s and think it was as turbulent as it was, but a lot of things, the rules of the game were changing. Technology, including the hydrogen bomb, had just come onto the scene. There was rapid technological change. He was the first president to preside over the space age. And all of these changes required getting set up and creating frameworks for the future. And so I wrote the book because how does a person who bears that kind of responsibility, how do they think about life? And I hope that's the contribution I made, because I assert that he led with both his head and his heart, which is what drew people to him.
What was a distinguishing characteristic that you could draw out about that leadership? Was it in the way he handled command and control? Was it decisions? Was it a level of empathy that he brought to it? Sternness? I mean, what were some of the characteristics that defined his leadership that really, at a critical time in the country's history, as you just noted, a lot of things on a number of fronts were beginning to explode in the 1950s when he became president, coming off the heels of a very successful war, but costly war. He had that sobering perspective of what the nation had just been through, but real time could see what its future potential could be. And that required a certain set of skill sets as a leader.
Well, let me, if I may, answer it half analytically and half personally. And by the way, I should say, Michael, this is the first time I've ever put my grandfather into a piece of analysis or what I knew about him. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was time that we heard that additional voice. On a personal side, let me just say that it's very clear he had seen some of the darkest places humankind has ever gone. He liberated a concentration camp and set the policy that exists today. Thank God he insisted that the Holocaust be chronicled, or Holocaust deniers would have no evidence to refute their assertions. And yet, for all those dark places and all those dark things he'd seen, he was never hard or cynical or bitter, or he maintained an enormous optimism about the future, and he was always interested in the future and to try and mold the post-war period in a way that would avert catastrophe like that from ever happening again. Now, as an analyst, and by the way, my family was well taught how to compartmentalize these two things, I think his attraction to the American public is that they trusted him.
Right.
11 men had been in uniform during World War II, and most of them in the European theater, and he was their commander-in-chief, and they trusted him, and part of the reason they trusted him was that he did have an empathy for them. I think that scene of Ike with the 101st Airborne just before they set off to go to Normandy, he had been told by his technical expert that between 50 and 70% of those young men would not survive. And Eisenhower didn't believe that was the case. He thought that they had, gone through all the planning very carefully and this and that, but he still had the empathy and the courage to go look those young men in the faces. And he didn't give them a pep talk about what they're about to do. They were well-trained and they knew what they were about to do. But he talked to them about home and fishing and hunting. He even talked about football scores with them to kind of give them a lift and a mm-hmm. way to think about what they were going to come, that they could come back to, a home. And so I think That's very important, because empathy is actually fundamental to trust, and trust is fundamental to great leadership. Then I would say you can have all the trust in the world, but if you're not organized and if you're not disciplined, then things can fall apart. And in that, he had the experience of the war to really put together an administration that pursued the facts wherever they went, and to try and shape an environment that would meet a set of long-term strategic goals. I'm finished on that one, but it's a complicated answer, isn't it?
No. Because I was going to say, you raise a couple of very interesting questions for me in your answer. I'm curious how General Eisenhower translated into President Eisenhower, because the skills, the leadership skills, while on the face, yes, the president is commander in chief, may seem very similar, if not exactly the same, there is a difference between how you deal with the realities of war versus the realities of an economy, or the realities of what was emerging at that time, civil rights. And of course, he was one of the few in the military who, you know, successfully was promoting and pushing out the civil rights of soldiers within the military itself, which was that great sort of training field, if you will, for those to really begin to see what this whole thing would be about. But then you layer on top of that the politics. Now, look, we know the military is full of politics. That's for sure. But even to that extent, there's a different degree of it in a military setting versus a purely, you know, wretchedly raw political setting. How did you chronicle that? How did you see that in your grandfather, and how did he make that transition from a wartime five-star general to commander-in-chief of, you know, and civilian leader?
Well, it's interesting. Ike once wrote after the war, and when he was chief of staff of the Army, because yes, there is a lot of politics, especially when you get back to Washington, around defense spending and the rest of it. He said as commander, the hardest part was to decide on his own thinking about strategy. And then once he had a clear notion of how they were going to proceed, then it was fairly easy, because you issue an order and people do what they're going to do. But he said, with some irony in a secret diary, he says, the problem in Washington is making up your mind about what you want to do is just the beginning of the problem.
Oh, my gosh, that's so true.
Yeah, but what he did, so actually the adjustments of trying to unearth people's motives and where their interests lay politically, obviously, is different than it is in the military. But he was a fast learner. He made a few mistakes during the campaign in 52, but he was a fast learner. However, having said that, he did bring a certain military mentality. During the war, he had to navigate relationships that were sometimes very testy and difficult. You know, the British had a completely different way of looking at strategy during that war, and Ike was the decider. So he, you know, had a lot of strong personalities he had to deal with. And a lot of people feel sorry for him for having to put up with that during the war. Actually, I think he rather liked it, because when I got into my research, I realized actually as president, he organized the White House the same way he did during the war. And that is to say that he had a very tough chief of staff, and then he had a very, very diverse cabinet, conservative Republicans, I mean, really conservative Republicans, Republican moderates, and he even had some Republican liberals. And then he made them all come to cabinet meetings once a week, and they all had to know what was on the agenda, and they had to study it before they came. And then he just let them debate it, and he listened very carefully. He sort of led the debate to some degree, and then he would leave, and he'd make a decision, and then somebody would be tasked with implementing that decision. the way, I guess what I'm trying to say is that he liked pushback.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to take his own assumptions about things as correct. He wanted lots of pushback so that he could see the dimensions of the issue. And I think, of course, you'd have to do that during the war, wouldn't you? A million moving parts in the analysis. Finally, I just want to say, you mentioned civil rights. And again, I call that chapter Establishing a Beachhead, because not only was did he make some strides during the war in that area, but by the end of his two-term presidency, he had desegregated virtually everything the federal government controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his strategy. It was he desegregated Washington, D.C., for instance, the Department of Defense schools. He actually put meat on the bones of Truman's desegregation of the military. And let me tell you, when General Eisenhower told you to do certain things, you were doing them. federal contracting, it goes on and on. But his most lasting accomplishment there, I believe, was his federal judgeship appointments, because no white supremacists need apply to the Eisenhower administration for that. Of course, the Supreme Court worked in partnership with him, and he sent the 101st Airborne Division to desegregate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. So in contrast to what we've seen here recently, actually, the airborne forces were used to escort 9 African-American students into Central High School and to protect them from the white mob. And so it's sort of I found researching that whole topic very interesting. And I think it's obviously a very, very timely subject.
Well, and it raises for me the next question, because it speaks to the heart. So we have all that as the backdrop, a sort of a flavor of the man himself, and his leadership style. But even as early as, you know, before he became president, this sort of thinking about some of these bigger issues that he would get to play not only a role in, but really kind of direct as president of the United States, specifically on the civil rights front. How has his, you know, President Eisenhower's brand of leadership been lost in today's political class writ large, but specifically within the Republican Party, which has been one of my great frustrations, quite honestly? Anyone who listens to my podcast, if you heard me rant about the abject failure of party officials to adhere to the basic outline of leadership. just do it like step one, you know, raise your hand and say no or stop, or that's not what we believe. How has Eisenhower, his leadership, been lost in all of that?
Well, first of all, I think his leadership was hard for many scholars to understand for a long time, because he had a very, a multifaceted way of approaching an issue. So if he assessed that it would set the cause back by using the bully pulpit because people would be energized against him, he'd work behind the scenes. He had, and I go through this in the book, all the little tools he had in his strategist toolbox. I think he, when it came to the Republican Party, he had his difficulties in the first term, because they, like today, the GOP was at a turning point.
Yeah.
And the issues were a little starker, in the sense that they were more issue-based, perhaps, than they were differences of tone and of culture.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, there were some big differences between the internationalist viewpoint, which was Eisenhower's, and the isolationists. And, you know, there were differences around the economy. And Eisenhower believed in a social safety net. Of course, a middle-of-the-road social safety net.
Right.
But many of the conservatives in the party thought it was appalling. They wanted tax cuts. That sound familiar? but you know, the whole tone of how he operated, he did not believe that insulting people directly in public would ever accomplish anything. He was of the view that attacking people personally would be to assure yourself a longer-term enemy, and that actually the whole point of the exercise was to get people to cooperate, to bring about progress and a reorientation to, a modern Republican Party, but also the modernization that was required after the war. And so I think social media has had a lot to do with it.
Right.
I think we found over time as a country that you'd get more headlines and it'd be more exciting if there were real drama underway. I didn't like that stuff at all. You know, he didn't like dramatics. He didn't like emotionalism. He being quite an emotional person himself, and I can attest to that. But this was all about self-discipline, and he really believed that the public had to have confidence in the conduct of their own government, or it was a threat to our democracy. I say in one part in the book, he believed deeply in the necessity for internal cohesion and the political and economic strength to withstand our adversaries' desire to exploit our differences. So I would say today these deep divisions, not only in both parties, but mostly in the Republican Party, where it's still evident, but within our society itself, is a national security issue.
And at a minimum, he would not recognize this party nor see himself reflected in it today.
I think he would. I think, wow. I think that is absolutely fair to say. I think he'd be heartbroken because a lot of people asserted that he did not pay much attention to the Republican Party during his presidency. I think that's incorrect. In my research, especially my research among the memoirs that were done by his aides, he was constantly trying to get young people into the party and to run for public office. And if you think about it, the moderate wing of that party really survived. Well, I should ask you because you're the expert here, but certainly through George H.W. Bush's tenure.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's an absolute fair statement to make. And in fact, you could see the sort of Nixonian element of the party emerge. You know, Nixon's strategies as vice president were very different than, well, not maybe not that much, for when he was running as president. But then sort of playing to that, some of those baser instincts to win is not a takeaway that I had of Dwight Eisenhower and his leadership. In fact, in a number of speeches that I've given over the years, I've always referred to him as you know, I would put him and Reagan 1-2 in terms of bookends of that period of Republicanism that sort of, you know, raised the bar a little bit. Higher every time, you know, and, you know, bringing the kind of leadership skills to the table that were required in the moment. So I think that's a fair point that you make in terms of how he would look at all of this. And those Republicans sort of response to that. And I think it's the absence of the kind of leadership that Eisenhower exhibited. And it's very interesting to hear you talk about his desire to push younger people into leadership roles in the party, to run for office, et cetera. I think that's very telling in a lot of ways about, you know, that side of him that understood exactly what else the moment afforded him as being not just president, but head of a political party.
Well, first of all, he recognized that the Constitution makes the president head of state, head of the executive branch, and head of a political party, which are absolutely contradictory responses.
Is it? Right, exactly.
Yeah, so he left a lot of the really messy political stuff for behind the scenes because as head of state, he wanted to, you know, project confidence and assurance that everything was under control. Back to this bringing young people into political life, you might be amused by this story, but I remember this so well personally, and of course I had to put it in the book, but my grandfather hated to talk on the telephone, and I think there's a, you know, a genetic streak in all of us. My siblings are the same way, and so am I. So, you know, he could be, he'd do almost anything to set up a personal meeting instead of trying to talk on the phone. But anyway, I was shocked one day when he was watching Meet the Press, and there was a governor from Oregon named Mark Hatfield, who was on. He was running for the Senate. And this is like Sunday morning, and everybody's, you know, he had his coffee, and he's sitting in the swivel chair that he always sat in. And as the more Hatfield talks, he's leaning closer and closer to the television, okay? He wants to hear everything this man's saying, and he's running for Senate. Right after the program is over, I was astonished by this. He went over to the telephone and placed a call to the television station and said he wanted to talk to Governor Hatfield. Okay, well, who's calling? Well, this is Dwight Eisenhower. Oh, my God. They pull Hatfield off the stage, and then I heard them talking. I only heard Granddad's end of the conversation. So many years later, before Mark Hatfield left the Senate, I said, Senator, did you ever have a call from Dwight Eisenhower after, you know, a television presentation, Meet the Press, I think it was, and he said, oh, my God, did I ever.
I love it.
He said, the waters parted for me after I got off the phone and left the station. I thought that was just wonderful. But he was doing that kind of thing all the time. If he saw talent, people would hear from him, and he'd try and talk them into running, or even in some cases, you know, where he was enthusiastic, would lend his support. And he had a lot of political gatherings up in Gettysburg, you know, for candidates and that type of thing.
We are having a great conversation with Susan Eisenhower, the granddaughter of Dwight Eisenhower, and the author of the new book, How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. We're going to have more conversations with Ms. Eisenhower when we come back, because we're going to be getting into conventions and upcoming election, and that's going to be fun. We'll be right back.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. As I said, we're having this wonderful conversation with Susan Eisenhower and her new book, How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. We're talking about leadership. Susan's referred to the book as a book really on leadership. How do you, Susan, when you're sort of assessing the 70 some days left in this presidential political cycle, and you consider the current occupant of the White House, who doesn't play well with others by any stretch of the imagination, When you consider, I think one of the more interesting things about being president is language, how you speak, what you say. It's not, leadership, of course, is a lot of what you do, and sometimes in a given speech that you may put on. But it is the day-to-day conversation you have with the country, particularly at times of crisis. And obviously for Dwight Eisenhower, one of the big emerging crises at the time was, we already talked about a little bit, was civil rights, and how for him it was, he personalized it in a way, because he had that sort of experience as general in the service of the country, but now as president he had to sort of refashion it and have a different conversation about this subject with the American people. How important is that in terms of communicating ideas and even feelings and emotions about events? As we struggle with COVID-19, I think it's fair to say most Americans feel it would be the equivalent of you catching a cold and your parents, you know, stick their head in the room and go, "You still here?" and then leave. You know?
I'm sorry, that's really pretty funny.
You know?
Or I heard another one the other day. This would be like saying in the middle of the Blitz of London during World War II. No, I don't feel like turning off my lights at night, you know.
Even better. Oh, my God. That is such a great analogy. Yes. Could you imagine doing the Blitz?
My creed means that I can keep my lights on even during a bombing raid. I mean,
Could you imagine? And, of course, everybody in the neighborhood is going, okay, well, that house not going to be there tomorrow.
I'll say something like that. Well, first of all, I mean, we are in the middle of almost a perfect storm of crises. We've got the virus, and we've got an extreme set of circumstances in the economy. And you know, I'm sorry, the stock market only represents a certain economic activity. Unemployment is very worrisome, and you know, a lot of those jobs probably aren't going to come back, which is deeply worrying. Then we have all the normal crises that go with contentious relationships overseas and the rest of it. Well, I think how you talk to people is absolutely critically important. And I think Eisenhower did it, as you say, by personalizing the issue. But he was very adroit at, and we got this at the dining room table all the time, because my brother and I were always, always competing with each other to make some political or, historic or some other kind of point. It was kind of fun. And then, Granddad would say, wait, how does it look to the other guy?
Wow.
Okay, so we asked to go through this whole analysis, and I think it actually helped me a lot later professionally, just to start out with, now let's see, who am I talking to, and what is the context of their life?
Mm-hmm.
I think if we had more of that analysis, we would find today that the divisions are created around almost parallel universes that exist in this country, and we have to find the language to bridge those universes. Because, frankly, everything depends on it. I don't think people can be metaphorically ignored as a group of people without damaging all of us. And if you take the civil rights case, for instance, the 1957 Civil Rights Act,
mm-hmm.
which was that Eisenhower got passed through Congress. I mean, it's sort of an amazing thing. Of his 8 years, six of those years, the Democrats controlled both houses in Congress, and Eisenhower still got 80% of his legislative agenda through Congress,
wow.
Which is rather amazing. And I think one of the really moving parts of this book is how the kind of relationship that Eisenhower and Johnson forged, Lyndon Johnson, it's really a testament to both of them. But the president understood that he had things he wanted to get done in this country, and it would take building mutual trust with the Democrats. So that Civil Rights Act gets passed, and as a matter of fact, the voting rights section of it, in 57, the compromise had to be around the voting rights, or else the bill wouldn't have passed.
Right.
And Ike made some adjustments in the 1960 bill. But the Democrats really took issue with him over certain things that Ike thought were fundamental for civil rights. That is, getting a judge to decide upon, cases that were prejudicial to African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And those Democrats wanted jury trials. And I said, but, the juries could be racist, and this isn't going to help their cause. Well, anyway, the point being is that even though Ike didn't get everything he wanted into the Civil Rights Bill, though he made big progress, when John Kennedy brought out his Civil Rights Bill, do you know that Dwight Eisenhower actually not only endorsed it publicly, he did two other things. He told the GOP candidate for president, Barry Goldwater, that if he didn't support the Civil Rights Bill, he Dwight Eisenhower, would vote for Lyndon Johnson.
Wow.
And he also promised Kennedy before.
And so he voted for Lyndon Johnson that year.
Well, he didn't get. But what's interesting is that even though John Kennedy had voted against the jury trial piece in committee, when John Kennedy came out with his proposed bill, I called him up and said that he would lobby his fellow Republicans to help Kennedy pass that bill. Now, I just can't imagine that, a situation like that today almost.
Yeah.
I mean, we're so, tribalized, I guess. And
yeah, no, that's exactly the word, yeah.
Yeah, and also people, you know, are adherents to their party, and they think any kind of compromise is a sign of weakness. What? And I would say it's quite the reverse, actually.
You know, I would agree. It is quite the reverse. It is an ultimate sign of weakness because you've become dependent to the exclusion of everything else. And when you see yourself, and most especially define yourself that way, then it doesn't bode well at all. How do you, Susan? When you're looking, as we're going to this Republican convention, it's going to be about Trump. We know that already. They're doing some scrambling now to sort of, because they listened to Trump all this time, they're no longer going to be in North Carolina. They're going to be in Florida. And now they're probably meeting on I-95 somewhere. We don't know exactly where. But wherever they are, they're trying to do this virtual thing, this beholden to the wiles and whims of one person for a party is a very difficult and ultimately detrimental thing to do. When you have that kind of environment, where does the growth, is there any room for growth, or are we just kind of waiting for a leader or leaders to emerge who are in the vein of your grandfather, you know, to their core, understand what Republicanism is, based on what Republicanism's history has been, and the battles that we, you know, that the party had taken on, as you just articulated very well in the civil rights space, for example. Where did we go? Where does that leadership come? And should it be tapping into that sort of Eisenhower-esque spirit for some guidance on how to reemerge on the other side of all of this?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful question, and I think you know this way better than I do. You've had such a distinguished career, and by the way, so many important positions that actually, you know, give you an insight that I can only guess at here. But I would say that my takeaway from writing this book and then looking around me is that, first of all, we suffer from a couple of very big cultural problems, which is that now you're either a winner or you're a loser. I mean, this is like a very simplistic way of looking at it, but that's what we call people these days. Mm-hmm. Oh, so-and-so's a winner, so-and-so's a loser. But what about human development? What about somebody growing and maturing? What about getting knocked down a couple of times and getting up and doing better and actually, you know, ultimately winning? Where is the nobility and the excitement around that idea? One thing I loved about reading, and there are many, I use a number of cases in the book about this, but Ike really believed in second chances. You know, he had not the greatest disciplinary record at West Point, and he, you know, was above 50% academically, but he broke his knee and couldn't play football. And, you know, I would say it took him a while to settle down and get serious.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody at West Point had dubbed him as a loser, as a matter of fact, you know, imagine how history might have been different. No, the Army actually believes in development mm-hmm. of people. So our culture likes this winners and losers bit. And then the other thing, and you know this way better than I do, but these elections are all about playing to your base.
Yep.
I mean, there's a possibility that the current president of the United States is going to, quote unquote, win this election, having massively lost the popular vote. And this is, I think it's actually getting a little bit scary that we don't, you know, that the whole strategy for the election is just to make that incremental difference around the Electoral College and not to be drawing on larger themes. Michael, if I could make one other point,
sure.
And I think that this is the way the way I got some of these civil rights achievements is that, and it was very unpopular in some circles and maybe still is, but it was just quintessential Eisenhower, is that he knew he needed the Southerners to pass the civil rights legislation, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were Democrats at the time. But so instead of, actually, he said plenty of times that the way certain situations were unfolding were indefensible. But he never attacked people personally because instead what he tried to do, which was more positive and I think more constructive ultimately, was to find something everybody could agree on. And in this particular case, what they could agree on was the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just a significant approach. So we're not trying to find the common ground. And I think that's a source of real worry. It could get a lot scarier out there than it is right now, that's saying something.
Yeah, no, I think that's where the point you've raised here in our conversation and really the point of the book is that leadership makes a difference. It matters, certainly at critical times in history, but hell, just day to day. Who the leader is and who the leaders are and what they're willing to sacrifice on behalf of the greater good. When you have a political culture that, as you correctly identified, that emerges as tribal, and within that tribalism is a narcissism unlike anything we've ever seen before, where it's not just an extension of Donald Trump, it's an extension of all of those in that tribe, because it's about me, and the fear, the setup, and I have to say, quite honestly, fake, phony fear of others, because all that does is it masks a lot of things that your grandfather had to confront as a general and had to confront as president in trying to move through a lot of these civil rights battlefields. Particularly on the lines of race, all of that is now, that becomes, comfortable for people. And so the leadership matters to get us off of those things that are ultimately harmful to our democracy. And when that leadership engages in those very harmful practices, what the hell do you think is going to happen? what do you think this looks like in 5 years or 15 minutes? And we've seen that narrative play out in a way that I think raises some real concerns, particularly when, and this is a one where I know all 44 predecessors to this president, maybe perhaps one or two would probably get where he's coming from and agree with him. When you have the president talking about, well, I'm not sure if, I will, concede the election if I, quote, lose, because it's going to be rigged anyway. You're sitting here going, wait a minute. So now you've cast doubt on the very franchise that we have as citizens, that we can do this fairly, equitably, in a way that honors the Constitution. And at the appropriate time, if you need to hit the road, you need to go. And you're telling us now, no, I may not do that. How does that disrupt, sort of the legacy of presidents like Eisenhower, particularly in the Republican space, because it's so antithetical to everything that we've ever espoused? I mean, you and I both know, Susan, that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, these very same Republicans would be popping their heads off if a Democratic president was behaving and saying and doing the things that Trump is doing. We saw how they behaved with Barack Obama. they damn near lost their mind with him. And the worst thing he said, well, I'm just going to do an executive order on DACA. How do we as people recover from that? And what is the strength that we can look to from the past in sort of establishing or setting a standard for the leader we want starting this November?
Well, I think it's nice to hear somebody finish someone else's sentences. I really like that. Yeah, I start with the first part. Character matters. Leadership matters, but so does character. because that's what defines the bond of trust between large groups of people and the leader. And I got to tell you, trust has to be earned every day.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it almost doesn't matter what is said on the Republican side during this convention, because their actions have already pointed people in a different direction. I mean, in other words, if Trump or any of the other officials stand up and talk about uniting the country, we've just seen evidence that that hasn't been the case during some very, very crucial moments in those several crises that I mentioned.
Right.
I'll tell you one thing that absolutely floors me is U.S. Postal Service issue.
Mm-hmm.
I have to, why aren't people asking themselves, how can we have an executive branch that would rather expose people in a time of pandemic to the virus rather than give the right to vote to everybody?
Right. Make it as easy as possible for them to vote in a safe environment. Yeah.
In a safe environment. So
I think people are actually coming around to that. I think people are starting to hear the question you've posited and are starting to respond. And I think that's why you saw the Postmaster General back off of at least furthering the deconstruction of our postal system for this upcoming election. Now, he did say to Nancy Pelosi that, well, I have no intention of replacing the mailboxes that we've taken out of neighborhoods, and I have no intention of reinstalling the sorting machines that we've removed. So from that standpoint, their work has been accomplished in that they've hobbled the system in such a way that it becomes questionable at best, unreliable at worst. And I think that that's one of the big remaining concerns. So talk about leadership, Susan. This is where I think a lot of us out here are waiting for the Congress to bring the hammer down on this administration. And you know what my attitude is, quite honestly, Susan? Okay, let them squeal that you can't do that, that you it's illegal. I'd have U.S. Marshals haul his behind before my congressional committee in a heartbeat. I wouldn't wait for this some polite you show up and go through all that dance. I'm like, no, go get him. Bring him here so we can question him. I mean, that's, for me, what this moment requires in the kind of leader that I think your grandfather would have been, the way he handled Central High School when he saw
right.
black kids being prevented from getting an education. He said, wait a minute, hold time. Oh, hell no. Get those guys over there in uniforms and have them go down there and escort these kids to school and tell that governor, I dare him to try my patience on this. That's what I'm talking about.
Boy, I like that. And that's about what he did, too. I mean, he gives Governor Faubus one chance to do the right thing. And when Faubus didn't, I'm telling you, it's called overwhelming force, was sent down there. Eisenhower wrote a letter to the one of the parents of the Little Rock Nine,
mm-hmm.
and said it was a telegram. And they had an exchange of telegrams, and Eisenhower says that I shall continue to discharge that responsibility in the interests of all Americans today, as well as to preserve our free institutions of government for the sake of Americans yet unborn. And then he says to Mr. Brown, he says, I believe that America's heart goes out to you and your children in your present ordeal. In the course of our country's progress towards equality of opportunity, you have shown dignity and courage in circumstances which would daunt citizens of lesser faith.
Wow. He got it.
Yeah, he got it.
He got it.
You know what? He got it, but to your point, he didn't mess around.
Right.
So what's really dispiriting right now is the kind of passivity that you see in quarters where they really do have the authority to look into this and to look into it without kidding around.
Yeah. Now, it is in many respects the quintessential test of leadership, is what you do in that moment when you think you can't do anything. And that's, that to me, that was what President Eisenhower faced in that moment when these white segregationists were saying, we're not letting this Northerner tell us what to do, and giving off the impression, even from members of his own party at the time, you can't really do that. You can't, putting the brakes on, setting the limits. And that test is, what do you do when everyone tells you you can't do something? And that's,
well, you know, he was a constitutionalist, and he had, he and the Supreme Court took this on. Mm-hmm. And I think what you've said is just so articulate, because really that is the question, is how does an administration find itself able to do some of these things?
Yeah.
I think it's remarkable, but the most fundamental thing that we have as citizens is our ability to vote. And that this is even called into question at this particular time, I think, is alarming. And I do worry personally about more physical violence in this country. And who is going to emerge here? That's the question I have.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about that? Offer us some hope here, Michael.
Well, you know, the hope for me rests in three very foundational words: we the people. We have to recognize, and the folks who listen to my podcast, you've heard me say this before many times, and I will continue to say it until everyone figures it out, that we are the final arbiter. Our government is us. It's not a building. It's not an Oval Office, nor is it the occupant behind the Resolute Desk. It's us. So that's what someone like a President Eisenhower understood, you know, that in that space that he had to represent us, and he had to do as we should and would want him to do. I'm hoping that person emerges in a way that restores our confidence. Yeah, we feel battered and beaten up by a lot of the institutions, but that's because we've allowed them to run roughshod over us. You know, instead of holding our leaders accountable, we reelect them. And so, you know, we've sort of put ourselves into this tribal box, and it's going to be up to us to get out of it. That's why I was so inspired by this book, because, you know, for me, the bookends as a Republican, obviously Lincoln is the foundation for me. That's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican. But the bookends that are on top of that foundation are Dwight and Reagan, in my view. And I know mm-hmm. some will argue about Reagan or whatever. For me, this was a 17-year-old kid who was like, damn, this guy makes sense to me when I was a young man. And, you know, unfortunately, came of age and into the political space shortly after Eisenhower passed. So I really kind of missed his physical presence on the political landscape. But, you know, my education and my learning of him told me, yeah, this guy was kind of one of a kind. You know, he did some things at a time and in a way that really answered the question about leadership. You know, what do you do when you're told you can't? What do you do when everyone around you is saying no? What do you do when you know the right thing is to do something? So I'm really excited for the book. I really hope people pick it up, particularly now, and read it over the course of this election before you go in to vote in November, or get your ballot early and sit down and read the book and then fill out the ballot. Because I think it's important for you to I think it's important for us to appreciate what leadership really looks like at difficult times and in challenging times for the country, and how it rises up, but most importantly, how it lifts us up too. And I think that's what Dwight Eisenhower did at a very important time for a lot of us. Just so for the record, we all are very clear. The last time a Republican got a majority of the black vote, it was for a man named Dwight Eisenhower. Think about that. So Susan Eisenhower, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing a little bit of your grandfather with us, our president, our former president of the United States. The book is How Ike Led, the Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Susan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. That does it for this time together, folks. You know, we'll be back because I can't resist you, right? I'll be back, and I'm hoping you will join us. Don't forget to download us at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And follow the work of Susan at Eisenhower Group on Twitter. And
Yes, just at Eisenhower Group. Or Eisenhower Group.
Yeah, yes. at Eisenhower Group. You'll find it on Twitter at Eisenhower Group. And please go out and get a copy of How Ike Led. I think you'll appreciate it and really begin to understand what leadership means at critical times for all of us. Thanks a lot. Catch you all next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.